Our first presenter today really needs no introduction at all. It's our illustrious president, Tim Brooks.
All right, Tim Brooks.
In addition to being ARSC's current president, Tim is also a Grammy Award winner and the author of several award-winning books on the history of the recording industry, including the book Lost Sounds, Blacks and the Birth of the Recording Industry, which never leaves my desk, I can say. And the title of Tim's presentation today will be Minstrelsy on Record. Welcome to Tim Brooks.
All right, I hope everybody has a copy of the handout because some of these things will be a little hard to understand without it. Carrie is there giving it out. But make sure you get a copy of the handout. Also archive it, digitize it, store it under optimal conditions and temperature-controlled archives and all the other stuff you do with handouts from ARSC presentations. How many people here have been to an actual minstrel show, seen a performance? Mm-hmm. One, two, three, four. Well, your own definition, five. I'm on a minstrel show, Chris. A minstrel show. Gentlemen be seated. Although it should be gentlemen and ladies be seated now, I guess. If I'd asked that question 100 years ago, not 150, 100 years ago, early 19th century, 20th century, every hand in the room, I guarantee, would have gone up. It was a very familiar form of entertainment right into the early 20th century. And there's a lot of literature about it. It's a popular subject in academic circles, those of you who move in those circles know. Books like Behind the Burnt Court Mask and Blacking Up, which talk extensively about minstrelsy. I think you can probably get PhDs in it these days. But most of these studies tend to lose interest, I guess you'd say, when you get much past the Civil War, particularly when you get to the 1880s, 1890s. They talk about minstrelsy as either fading out, being driven off the stage by vaudeville, which was the rising form then. Some even say minstrelsy as a commercial enterprise was dead by the 1890s. And I'm here to tell you that was not the case. It was very much alive. It was morphing and changing, as we'll see. But it was very much alive, and therefore it overlapped with the beginning of the recorded sound era, which is kind of remarkable. Kind of remarkable. Look at that. It apparently does not want to be heard. Let it go? Okay, I'll bring it back when I can. That's too bad, because there's some interesting stuff here. Anyway, it was very much alive at the early days. Commercial recorded sound began essentially in 1890. Obviously, as many of you know, it was invented before that, but as a commercial proposition, 1890 forward. And so when commercial sound recording began, in fact, minstrelsy was still very much alive. Now, how popular were these records? Well, we're going to explore that. The next picture, which you probably will see eventually, is a short beginning of a very short course on the origins of minstrelsy, just so you'll know that we're coming from. There were blackface performers on the American stage in the 1820s and 1830s, solo acts, perhaps Thomas Daddy Rice being the most familiar. He had what he called a Jump Jim Crow routine, a song now known as Turkey in the Straw. In 1843, four of these solo entertainers got together and formed a group, kind of an informal group, they called the Virginia Minstrels. And they worked up an act where they sat on a stage in a little semicircle and traded jokes back and forth. They each had instruments. They were very, very popular. This was in New York, and therefore were immediately imitated widely. And so over the next few years, there were groups of four to six, usually, of these black-faced entertainers performing as units. And typically they would have a trade jokes back and forth. It'd be accompanied by banjo and fiddle. For rhythm, the two on the end would use a tambourine on one end and bones together on the other end, from which they became known as Tambo and Bones. Welcome back. So those were the origins, and most books will tell you the origins of minstrelsy were 1843 for that reason, first formal presentation. Just give me a moment.
All of these people were white.
All of these people, 99% of them at that time were white, yes, working in blackface. Blackface much precedes minstrelsy for that reason, solo performers with this mask on. Now, you'll have to give me just a moment here while I find the proper place. And we go to, I think I know a shortcut here. Okay, recent documents, okay. This would have befuddled the early minstrels greatly. They probably would do a routine about it, actually. Okay, click, oh, there we go. All right, how's this? And, okay, we're back. So this is what a minstrel troupe looked like at that time. As I say, 4 to 6 entertainers, generally speaking. With the instruments as I described them. Very quickly, a man by the name of Edwin P. Christie adopted this form, made it his form, and put groups out on the road and kind of formalized the form and became the leading entrepreneur of minstrelsy in those early days. He featured current popular songs, and he needed a stream of them, so he hired a young songwriter named Stephen C. Foster, who ground out songs for him for this. Those were current popular songs of the day. They weren't oldies. And those became known through through Christie's minstrels primarily. Christie even put his name on some of them. And the format that he evolved was in three acts. Act one was called the first part. The opening, gentlemen be seated, jokes between the end, blast of the orchestra to get the energy up, jokes between the end men, song by a featured performer. The second act would be called the Olio. That was a series of individual acts, like a vaudeville show, singers, banjo players, stump speeches, which are these nonsense speeches. And the third act would be the afterpiece, which would be a more extended production, like a playlet or maybe a competition. So it's the first part, the Olio, and the afterpiece. When I first started collecting minstrel records, I kept finding minstrel first part, and I've got to find second part. And why am I finding only the first part? Where are the rest of the parts? Now I know why, because that's not parts, it's the name of the act. Now, there was plenty of mockery of blacks in these. They were performed by white men in blackface. The white men in blackface even do the women's roles as mammies and such. But it's important to remember that there was mockery of a lot of other people in these too. There were mockery of other immigrant groups like the Irish and German immigrants. There was mockery of the social order. There was mockery of rich, pompous whites in this. It was really a pretty subversive entertainment form. Sort of mocking pretension and difference wherever it was. It wasn't only about blacks, but it, obviously that was a central theme particularly because of the makeup. But it was a rather subversive form, and academics like to study it for that reason, because it's really the first time in American history that you had this kind of bottom-up type of entertainment, which was based on mocking the social order in all of its forms. After the Civil War, minstrelsy got much bigger and much grander. Big and elaborate troupes, spectacles, they went on foreign tours, but they still followed that same basic format. And here's a poster from 1877 for Haverly's Mastodon Minstrels. It kind of neatly illustrates what was going on at that point. Up at the top, there is the Grand Parade, which is the parade through town before the minstrel show starts to whip up excitement and get people to come to the show. In the middle, there's your Enmin and the interlocutor in the middle, who's interestingly pictured as somewhat larger than the other people, and Tambo and Bones at the end. At the bottom, on the left, as they call it, the resplendent cog tournament, and on the other side, the mammoth song and dance festival. Either one of those could be the afterpiece. And a nice big picture of the very respectable white proprietor of this whole entertainment, which would make it comfortable for families and mothers to bring their children and that kind of thing. So it's still the minstrel first part, the olio, and the afterpiece, but now on a much grander scale. And also, by this time, there began to be black minstrel troupes and integrated minstrel troupes, for that matter. Primrose and West's big minstrel show advertised 40 whites, 40 blacks. They began to talk about authenticity in their terms, such as it was, and many black performers who often blacked up as well to make their skin even darker and more kind of clown-like appearance would appear in these as well. It's interesting to look at this to figure out. Obviously, the blacks are on one side and the whites are on the other side, but which is which? Because they're kind of all made up. I think I figured it out. But so there were troops as big as 100 performers. There certainly were black minstrels, which were very popular, and there were integrated troops as well. Hugely popular in the 1870s and the 1880s, the predominant entertainment form in America at that time. But you did begin to see competition from vaudeville, which was essentially a spinoff of the olio portion. Now, we get to 1890. As I say, the beginning of the recorded sound era. And it's important to remember how people heard records and sound initially. It was through traveling exhibitors like this gentleman here. They would buy a phonograph, which was rather expensive in those days, often encased in glass, as this one is, and with listening tubes attached to it, like stethoscope tubes, and they would travel from town to town, and you would pay a nickel, and you would put the tubes to your ear, and you'd hear absolute magic. An orchestra is inside there, or a speaker is in. How do you get in there? And a speaker is in there, or Sousa's latest march is marching in there. So they needed a steady stream of pre-recorded cylinders, both speech and music, to use in their exhibitions. They would set up in parks, town parks, which looks like where this might be, or in ferry terminals or at resorts, and sometimes there would be permanent phonograph arcades of these devices, too. Here's another one. Gentleman in the back there is obviously the entrepreneur. Notice that all of the customers are all linked up to the magic machine listening. Are all white, first of all. You would not normally, I think, in America of that time, get blacks and whites listening to the same thing at the same time. In fact, most of the customers would be white. Rather few of them would be black. So the cylinders that were being made to sell to the entrepreneurs in order to have material to play and would be played primarily for a white audience. From the very beginning, one of the novelties that were made for these devices would echo the minstrel shows that everybody was familiar with. Everybody, I'm sure, in that picture had seen a minstrel show at some point, whether local or a national touring group or something. It was a very, very familiar form to them, as were the songs from minstrelsy. So to hear a kind of oral reflection of that was something they were very familiar with, and it was a great novelty for them. It seemed rather current for them. The earliest minstrel records that I have been able to trace are here on the screen. These are all made for Edison, or Edison North American, announced as Edison Records. Some of them we've found, some of them we haven't. Duffy and Imgrun Band's The Jolly Minstrel is apparently a instrumental band medley made in 1889. The Manhasset Quartet, or Manhasset Quartet if you prefer, fascinating title, Minstrel First Part, A High Old Time. That sounds like a real recreation. Nobody's ever found the cylinder, to my knowledge. If anybody has it, let me know. We only know it from the Edison recording books and from a title slip that has turned up. but not the actual cylinder. In 1889, Voss's band did 5 minutes with the Minstrels, another instrumental selection, which, by the way, ran for 2.5 minutes. So unless you heard it very slowly, you didn't actually get 5 minutes with the Minstrels. But that was a published selection of the time. And in December of 1893, Edison released 2 cylinders, minstrel first parts, specifically saying, introducing the middle and end men, gags and songs, accompanied by Banta's orchestra. So those, by the listings at least, must have been real recreations of a minstrel show. Unfortunately, nobody has turned those up either. So we're up to 1893. The person, though, the real breakthrough came in 1894, and it came due to this man. How many recognize who that is? Anybody?
Len Spencer.
Len Spencer was a young, very entrepreneurial man from Washington, D.C. He was fascinated with the phonograph from the time he first saw it. His family ran a business college in Washington. They had some of these machines. And he became both a recording artist, he could play some instruments and sing, a speaker in a very stentorian tone, and a producer, what we would call a producer. He put together skits and acts and that sort of thing. And in 1894, for the New Jersey Phonograph Company, he said, I will put together some sketches for you built around a minstrel show. And he formed a minstrel troupe for that purpose, just for recording, which he at first called the Spencer, Williams, and Quinn Minstrels. Later on, they became the Imperial Minstrels. This was not a troupe that performed on stage. It was specifically a recording aggregation. And one of the interesting things about it was that it was an integrated troupe. One of the members was George W. Johnson, who was quite popular at the time in his own right. He had 2 songs, basically, but they were enormously popular, his Laughing Song and his Whistling Song. This is a picture of him in 1900. And his role in the troupe was to contribute his hearty laughter. And I swear you can hear him in some of those early things, laughing at the corny jokes. And on some of the cylinders, he also sang his Laughing Song as the big number, which you'll hear later. So the Imperial Minstrels were an immediate hit in terms of those days. I know where Joel Whitburn puts them on his charts, but believe me, they sold a lot of records. And, of course, imitations sprung up. They themselves were lured away by the Columbia Company to start making cylinders for them in 1896, and they, in fact, became exclusive artists for Columbia in 1897 and recorded for others as well. Now, what did these cylinders sound like? Minstrel cylinders in the 1890s. Well, they were meant to replicate, give you an oral reading card, if you will, of the first part, minstrel first part, all in 2.5 minutes, 2 to 3 minutes. They would typically open with a stentorian gentleman be seated, or sometimes, interestingly, be seated gentleman, followed by an introductory overture. The orchestra gives a couple of blasts to raise the energy level. Then a few fast-paced jokes between either between the end men or the interlocutor and one of the end men, all accompanied by a lot of laughter and applause, which is where Johnson came in. Then a featured song, which usually consisted of 1 verse and a chorus, since that's all the time that was left, and a fast, rousing, maybe closing chorus with laughter and applause and so forth. So think about listening through that, through the magic box inside the glass. There's a minstrel show in there, and it sounds like the one we went to last month. One thing that's very interesting about these early minstrels is the kind of songs that were featured by these on these early minstrel records. These are the first 10 or so releases by the Imperial Minstrels on New Jersey cylinders, organized in descending order by year of publication of the song. So the first couple of songs at the top, these were made in 1894, were Two Little Girls in Blue and Sweet Marie. Those were current hits at the time. They were, and they there's not a, anything in racial about them. They're current popular sentimental songs. The Laughing Song was really a current hit at the time. It had just come out a couple of years earlier. Then there's a whole group of songs from the 80s and 70s, which were essentially the minstrel repertoire. There's a whole group of songs that had been written during this heyday of these big troops. Four minstrel shows, Buckle on the Golden Sword, and Hear Them Bells, and High Old Time, that kind of thing. Some of which had reference to kind of folk religion. They weren't really coon songs or really black songs, most of them. They were about minstrelsy, and they were loud, and they were fast, and they were meant to accompany the old minstrel show. Whole body of those. Nothing here from Stephen Foster, nothing here from before the Civil War. The picture you see here is of a very contemporary kind of entertainment, which, just like in Christie's day, is featuring current hits and some standards of the genre, but a lot of current hits, too. Two Little Girls in Blue, for crying out loud. These are the first dozen or so put out by the Imperial Minstrels, with some overlap, on Columbia. When they went to Columbia in 1896, they turn up a fair amount, actually. Most of them, again, are songs that are current hits. Goodbye, Dolly Gray, Hello, My Baby, Hello, My Honey, Mamie Riley, There's Two Little Girls in Blue again, with a few down there in the 80s, which are of that standards, minstrel standards group, Hear Them Bells and so forth. Finally, one by Stephen Foster, the oldest one that they recorded from 1851. But the picture you have here, again, is of a rather contemporary form of entertainment in the 1890s, contrary to a minstrel show as we think of it as being very much in the pre-war Stephen C. Foster kind of mold. Most of the, now, one of them, the one at the top, the most recent, 1901, must have been recorded in 1900, I guess, is a coon song, obviously. And it was a very popular song, so it's really a current hit. But most of these are not coon songs or specifically racially demeaning songs. Where you got the more demeaning material, certainly in our terms, is in the spoken content. The dialect and the back and forth between Tambo and Bones, for example. It's interesting in this regard that of the earliest ones, especially the New Jersey Cylinders, they are very kind of streetwise and almost kind of colloquial. They're not like the very stilted parlor ballads of the day and the very precise enunciation that you got in most entertainment, including vaudeville entertainment. It's almost as if they're trying to appeal to younger or lower class, maybe, buyers of cylinders, younger ones particularly. As an example of that, which I'll play for you, it's on your handout, is the first example. You'll need that to follow along, but try to follow along with this. This is, it's from the 1890s, mid-90s, so it's 120 years old, so you know, give it a break. It's going to be a little hard to understand. So bear with me on the sound quality. This is the Imperial Minstrels doing their Laughing Song. So Johnson is featured on this, on a New Jersey Cylinder. Our next song.
It's the Imperial Minstrel introducing their original minstrel first part. Please see, gentlemen. Introductory overture.
Where?
Around your neck.
Hey, Billy.
Well,
Another presentation, we'll listen to George W. Johnson. Interestingly, the dialogue became much more mainstream shortly after this, as they became more and more popular. Here are the Imperial Minstrels again, just a few years later, doing the same essential routine, or at least doing the laughing song again, and what they sounded like in 1902.
Gentlemen, be seated. I say, Mr. Henry, money is mighty cheap nowadays. Money cheap, Leonard? Ha! I failed to get any of it. Why, you can get silver dollars for 45 and 55 cents. Why, that's absurd. Nonsense. Everybody knows that 45 cents and 55 cents makes 100 cents, and you can get a dollar anywhere for that. Tell me, sir, why are the stars and stripes like the stars in the heavens? Well, Leonard, why are the stars and stripes like the stars in the heavens? Because, sir, it's beyond the power of any nation on earth to ever pull them down. George W. Johnson in his great laughing song.
Okay. You see how it changed, how the dialogue was so much more kind of formal and broad-based than it had been on those early cylinders. During the next 20 years, the popularity of these Minstrel records just exploded. All the labels entered the field. Edison started recording them, and Berliner and Victor and disc labels, everybody else. There are hundreds of them issued. I have 400 in my master discography that I've identified so far. 1913 seems to have been the high water mark, as late as that, when there were 34 of them listed in the Victor catalog alone. So they really spread. Along the way, one of the more interesting projects in 1903 was a full half-hour minstrel show on both Victor and Columbia, two different versions of it, we think produced by the same Len Spencer. Called An Evening at the Minstrels. It was a multi-disc set, or in Columbia's case, also a multi-cylinder set. And they were meant to be played back-to-back. So rather than each one opening with Gentlemen Be Seated, the first one did, but then it went on to some more jokes, it went on to a song, it went on to a whole record full of just back-and-forth jokes and so forth. And if you played them back-to-back, you would, in fact, get a half-hour minstrel show, complete with the oleo and even, in Columbia's case, the afterpiece. So here's just a short example from the Victor version. This is, if I can get down here, come on, where are you? Anybody see what happened? Oh, there it is. This is the cakewalk competition from An Evening with the Minstrels.
Thank you, partners, for the cakewalk. Crossover, come down,
in the interest of time, let me move on here. Sometimes said, are these really authentic or really a representation of what minstrel shows were really like? Well, remember, most of the performers on them had been in minstrel shows. Billy Murray here started out in a minstrel show before he ever started recording. And most everybody else, they knew what a minstrel show sounded like. And so did the buyers. And they probably wouldn't have bought so many of them if they had been terribly inauthentic. They are presumably a fairly good representation, even if they weren't made by the minstrel superstars of the day. There were a few minstrel stars who recorded, notably Lou Dockstetter, but mostly these were by studio people or others who had had experience in minstrel shows, replicating what the sound of them was like. In fact, Len Spencer got so deep into it, he put up a mechanical minstrel display at Coney Island with automatons and phonographs hidden behind them, and had a mechanical minstrel show there until it burned down. That's 1907, so obviously a rather popular form. There were also songs about minstrelsy, and I've listed some of those on the handout that you have on page 2. Well, there are songs that just in passing, but there were songs specifically about minstrelsy. Here are a couple of them. If you know of others than those that I've listed here, let me know. I'm sure there are others out there, particularly those that were recorded. These two I don't think were recorded. But here's a bit of a 1902 song about minstrelsy that was recorded. And notice how he makes fun of some of the cliches of minstrelsy. I need to do this. Get it to the...
It's got to be a minstrel show tonight, sung by Mrs. Anne W. Quinn. We want to see a minstrel show tonight. Do some ragtime steps and do them right. At the funny end, men, we want to peep. Want to hear that fella rock his cradle in the deep. Or else the show will end up in a fight. We came here with a minstrel appetite. We want to see a cakewalk done tonight. We want to hear the tenor sing so sweet. And the joke about the chicken that crosses the street. It's got to be a minstrel show tonight.
All right, so they were making fun of it even then. This is how many minstrel records were in the Victor catalog. Notice how it keeps going up. I don't know if you can read this until 1913, as I said, when it peaks. After that, the number in the catalog gradually declined until finally in the mid-20s, when electrical recording comes in, they delete the last of them because, of course, they were all acoustic recordings. That's far longer than most scholars trace minstrelsy as being a vibrant form. The later history, after 1900, it became more of a nostalgic format. You began to hear more older songs, the 70s, 80s songs, but also even pre-war Foster kinds of stuff. It was revived in the 1920s. There were a number of minstrel records made in the 1920s as pure nostalgia by that point. Much more of the Civil War stuff, generally more respectable. Coon songs had kind of gone out of favor by then, and the songs were things like By the Light of the Silvery Moon and general pop hits of the early era, as opposed to racially demeaning stuff. Minstrel Show, Victor Minstrel Show 1929 is a good example of that. And there's a long later history, too, for that matter, in films, on radio, even on early television. Of minstrel shows in the 50s, blackface, they kind of look like, good Lord, what are they doing at that time? And even longer in local halls and things like that. So it lasted for a very, very long time. But the big popularity seems to have died out basically before around World War I. Long history of minstrel shows in England. Many minstrel records made there. The troops went there, were very popular. They had their own troops starting in the 1840s. But the British had their own take on minstrelsy, as you might imagine. And here is a little bit out of, I have a hard time getting the cursor to find this thing. from a, I believe it's a 1929 performance on English Regal. There it is. This is an interesting take on Old Black Joe. Listen carefully.
Silence, please, for that favorite ballad, Poor Old Joe, sung by Master Hawtrey.
Yeah, those gentle voices calling. Well, that's the British take on nostalgic minstrelsy. Summary then to wrap up, wildly popular form on record for 20 years, surprisingly contemporary content, especially in the 90s, shows us how the jokes and dialogue were delivered. The mockery of African Americans, certainly a component to it. We can go into that later. But it was a very complex and evolving entertainment form. Which eventually turned to nostalgia, but not really until the teens and 20s. More on it in one of my books, and thank you very much.